This is Addiction Medicine Journal Club. I'm Dr. Sonia Del Tredici.
And I'm Dr. John Keenan.
We believe that addiction is a disease that can be treated, and we want to help you stay up to date with the latest research that you can use in your addiction medicine practice. And for our audience, we are now offering Category 1 CME credit through MyCares and Michigan State University. The links for the CME are in the show notes. So this week, we're going to be discussing whether reducing prior auths to buprenorphine leads to more providers prescribing this life-saving drug. So how are you doing, John?
I'm doing great today, Sonia. I did, in full transparency, just get some feedback from my number one fan, which is my mother, that I talk too quickly. And that while you sound very smart on these, she says she couldn't say enough how smart Sonia is. But she says, no, just try out of a place of caring. You should slow down your speech. So I just want to let you, the viewers or the listeners, understand that I'm going to be trying something new tonight to speak slower.
Well, I'm sure it'll go fine. And thank you, John's mom, for the helpful feedback. Please keep it coming. Before we get started, I just wanted to also ask a favor of our audience. So as I said before, we're now offering CME credit through MyCares, and I would like all of our listeners to tell at least one friend who might need CME credit about the podcast. So remember that if you have a DEA license that you're going to renew at some point in the next year and a half, you will need 8 hours of CME in opioid use and addiction medicine before that next renewal, and this podcast counts for that. So share the love and let your friends know that they can get their CME from us. John, is there anything you want to share with our audience this week in addiction news? You want to share it slowly?
Yeah, I read an article from NBC News, and it was just from last month, and it was very interesting. I like these kind of lay articles that kind of target people that possibly don't have a great background in addiction. And the article is titled, Why Are There No Treatment for Cocaine and Meth Addiction? And so late press article from NBC News, and kind of a little bit of background, they were talking about this rising overdose risk with co-administration of methamphetamine or cocaine with opioids. Last year, I was surprised by these statistics. 34,000 people died of methamphetamine-related deaths, 28,000 from cocaine-related deaths, so pretty high numbers. In 2021, 1.4 million Americans met the criteria for methamphetamine-related use disorder, 1.6 million for cocaine use disorder. So pretty high numbers, yet there is no FDA-approved treatment for this condition at this point. It went so far even as to talk about how the FDA has given guidance where they said that they would be welcome to a drug to be submitted to them for evaluation. So almost like the FDA is soliciting treatment medications for them to review for this condition. And really, there's been like a paucity of data for this. The last one they talked about was a New England Journal article from 2021 comparing combination bupropion and naltrexone versus placebo, which had a small increase. But besides that, there's really been almost like a wasteland of information about new drug combinations to target this. One thing that I liked that the article went one step further about talking was they talked about contingency management. So contingency management, as you know, is basically where someone's given an incentive to produce negative urine drug screens without a substance being present. A lot of people, even physicians that I know, they're very taken back by this concept of paying people for, like, quote, clean time or paying a patient to refrain from using a substance. Some states do have it currently reimbursed. I think California is the leader where they will reimburse up to $599 over a 6-month period for contingency management for methamphetamine use, but many other states don't. And the article made a very valid point. $599 for a drug for 6 months, that would be approved in a second by the FDA. And that would be approved in like a, you know, think of just our new weight loss medications at $1,400 per month. They're easily approved. Yet somehow we're resistant to this concept, even though it probably is financially viable. What that magic number is, I don't know what it is. In California, it's like about $100 a month. The data is variable.
It just made me think, like, how many of my diabetics, like, let's say we're on our, you know, GLP-1 agonists at $1,000 a month, let's round up. And I could tell the patient, look, I'll give you $1,000 cash a month if you can keep your A1C under 7, or I could spend $1,000 on this injection. So what'll it be, like low carb diet and daily exercise, or and $1,000 or injection? I bet some people could, that would be the right price, and maybe they would find that motivating enough.
But even at $1,000, right, there's this data, it's much less than that. It's like $100 in California. And I've seen studies showing anywhere from $59 to a couple hundred dollars per month. I think that the real question is, what is the sweet spot value there? But I don't know. I think it's an interesting question. You know, if pharmacotherapy doesn't work and counseling is moderately effective, is this something that we should kind of do a cost-benefit analysis and start to try to put into our healthcare system?
I mean, I think we should, because what's the cost of unbridled stimulant use? You know, like what's the cost of a cocaine-induced heart attack, or, you know, someone losing their job and their home and their family because of methamphetamines? You know, think of all that lost tax revenue when someone goes from a productive member of society to someone who's not working anymore. You know, I mean, it's got to be cost effective, I think.
Yeah, so interesting article.
You know, I had taken a little bit of a page out of the contingency management book for my office. I don't do a formal contingency management program at all, but I started giving out little prizes at my office. Not that you have to earn them. Like basically anytime you come in for a visit, now I have a big prize box and everyone who comes in gets a prize every visit they come for. And people really like it. I think it does inspire people to come in, even though they're not super valuable. It's like just a little something nice, a little kind of boost in dopamine when you come into the office that maybe helps you feel more positively about treatment overall. So I have my own little mini contingency management thing going, and people like it so much. Sometimes when people do video visits, they're sad they're not getting the prize, and they ask if they can stop by the office a different time when they're in our building and get their prize.
That's funny.
I always say, sure, just come on by.
How about you? What have you been reading about?
So there was an interesting article. I kind of wanted to get your take on it. We're not going to profile it in the Journal Club because it's not really a clinical article. It's just a mathematical modeling article. But it was called Examining Buprenorphine Diversion Through a Harm Reduction Lens. And so it was a statistical modeling paper, and they estimated the impact of buprenorphine diversion on overdose rates. And their model showed that greater buprenorphine diversion might lead to actually fewer overdoses. And again, just a modeling study, not a study of actual people. So they haven't proven that greater buprenorphine diversion leads to fewer overdoses. But it got me thinking about our current rules and practice habits related to patients with opiate use disorder. You know, many of our rules are designed specifically to prevent diversion. And maybe we shouldn't be worrying so much about that. I mean, I see a lot of my patients who are very stable on diverted buprenorphine, like buprenorphine they bought themselves from other people rather than prescribed buprenorphine, for many, many years. And I do know, you know, some of my patients occasionally share their buprenorphine with friends and family who might need it. Well, I don't officially condone this. You know, it's not legal. I don't think it's really healthy. It's not good for my patients to be giving away their medication, but I'm hard pressed to say that they cause a lot of harm in contrast to other opiates that might be diverted, like oxycodone. But, you know, we do all these urine drug screens. We really limit how much medication patients can have at any one time. We discourage stockpiling. You know, you can't fill your script even one day early because you might have some extra. Who knows what you're going to do with it? All in the name of preventing diversion. And maybe that's not necessary. Maybe we could give our patients like a little more slack. So I don't know. What do you think about loosening up some of these rules that are designed to just prevent diversion?
Yeah, this is like a loaded question, right? I think about
that. Yeah.
And I have lots of patients now that I've been taking care of for many years. And I feel like I've gone to like mini drug school just hearing them tell me like what's abused, how people are using it. Many non-controlled substances are abused in different ways. And everyone repeatedly tells me the same thing about kind of like buprenorphine. They typically buy it off the street to kind of mitigate withdrawal in between getting more drugs or to self-treat. I've never heard a patient told me that they've used it to get high or that they felt anything from it in that regard. I don't know. Have you?
I don't think so. I mean, almost all my patients have tried it in an effort to get off, you know, illicit fentanyl or treat withdrawal. I don't know anyone who sort of used it for pure pleasure, pure recreational uses. So I think people use it, you know, people use it to get off other drugs, and it is protective against overdose. The one thing I don't like about divertive buprenorphine and my patients who've been using it consistently, it really puts them still at mercy of other people who are selling them the drugs. You know, the supply is inconsistent. The price is inconsistent. They might have to do other favors for this person to get the buprenorphine. And I don't like that dynamic. So I prefer that they get it from a stable, legitimate source. But I think a lot of my patients might argue that doctors are inconsistent as well. You know, my patients do often have trouble with access. The pharmacy doesn't have it. In extreme cases, the doctor goes out of business and suddenly the patients are abandoned. So I won't claim we have a monopoly on consistency here.
Well, and it's, and you think of it compared to any other medical condition, I do think that from a cost perspective, that at times we spend a lot more resources than possibly we have to with this, right? I think kind of the copious urine drug testing, that's a cost. Some of that is cost to patient, not always covered by insurance. I think, you know, what other condition do you bring people back weekly and then monthly? And I have some patients that come to me as new patients that have been stable on buprenorphine for a decade, and their last doctor was still making them come in every 4 weeks, even though they have been stable for 10 years. Is that medically necessary? I mean, that's a question for each person to ask. I will tell you that person does not see me every 4 weeks. They see me frequently, but not every 4 weeks. And so I don't know. I think these are good questions to ask.
I do think it helps me relax a little bit, though, thinking of divertive buprenorphine as not something that harms society as a whole. And it will make me more comfortable, you know, with not worrying so much about what patients do. So, John, are you ready to talk about our article?
Yeah, definitely. So the article this month is a little different. This one is a policy article, so not kind of directly clinical. And it's called Removal of Medicaid Prior Authorization Requirements and Buprenorphine Treatment for Opioid Use Disorder. And it's from JAMA Health Forum from October of 2023. A little bit of background. Medicaid is the largest insurer of individuals with opioid use disorder. State Medicaid programs use a variety of utilization management policies, including prior authorization, to ensure safe delivery of care while containing cost and minimizing resource misuse. Not surprisingly, Medicaid utilization management policies have been directed at buprenorphine, among other drugs. Despite reducing morbidity and mortality among patients with opioid use disorder, buprenorphine treatment uptake has been limited relative to the burden of opioid use disorder and overdose deaths. Less than 4% of eligible clinicians prescribe buprenorphine for opioid use disorder. So let me repeat that. This study, 4% of clinicians currently prescribe for opioid use disorder, a very small percentage of us.
That's pathetic, everybody. Pathetic.
And that's part of why I'm covering this article. I think that expanding this is important. One frequently cited potential contributor to limited uptake of buprenorphine by clinicians and treatment advocates is prior authorization requirements. Critics of prior authorization for buprenorphine point out that many prior authorization requirements are not supported by evidence, including mandatory counseling, dose limits, and predefined tapering schedules, with little consideration of current evidence suggesting low-barrier on-demand addiction services, increasing treatment engagement, and limiting overdose risk. So not evidence-based in terms of the prior authorization requirements. And I think we see this with other drugs too. Not pointing out any particular drugs, but hepatitis C treatment definitely, I feel like, has a lot of this in it. Previous studies have shown that states with Medicaid programs requiring prior authorization for buprenorphine had fewer addiction treatment facilities that offered buprenorphine. So kind of presence of a prior authorization limits treatments in other settings. Previous studies have also demonstrated that states removing buprenorphine prior authorization requirements for Medicare patients showed strong associations with increased buprenorphine prescribing and decreased opioid use disorder-related emergency department visits and inpatient admissions. So decreasing these requirements was beneficial in multiple settings, not just the outpatient setting, but does trickle into our hospital care as well. Sonia, is prior authorization something that you really struggle with your practice?
Nope. I mean, for me, buprenorphine is almost always covered. There are very, very few incidences where it's not covered. And honestly, ironically, it's almost all private insurance. My Medicaid patients, Medicaid covers all forms of buprenorphine. How about you?
I'll be honest with you. I think when I started doing this, like 7 years ago at this point, I feel old saying that. But when you taught me initially, a young, bright-eyed, early attending, I feel like I did a lot more of them. I don't feel that way anymore. And they're crisis periods, right? Someone needs their medicine yesterday, and now I'm fighting with insurance Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. Thank you, Pennsylvania.
Thank you, Pennsylvania. No, it definitely has improved. When I first started, I had a whole binder that our CNC, our clinical nurse coordinator, set up. There was a whole binder of all the different prior auth forms we needed for all the different insurances so we could be ready for the BUP prior auths. But that binder is long gone, and I haven't had to dig it out since.
So the clinical question, is there an association between removal of Medicaid prior authorization for buprenorphine to treat opioid use disorder and buprenorphine prescriptions for Medicaid enrollees? So a little bit about this study. So this was a retrospective state-level serial cross-sectional study using quarterly data from 2015 to 2019 to compare buprenorphine prescriptions in states that did and did not remove Medicaid prior authorizations. The study population analysis was limited to states with prior authorizations in place at the start of 2015 that required fee-for-service and managed care plans to have similar prior authorization policies for buprenorphine and that had at least 2/4 of prescription data before and after the prior authorization was removed. So 2/4 of data before and after removal, so they had to have a baseline there. And they have to have similar policies since states often do differ in the fee-for-service and the managed care plans. And so this kind of out the gate limited to 25 states. Vermont was excluded due to buprenorphine prescribing rates that were considerably higher than the rest of the country. So when you looked at the data, Vermont was way, this kind of data point way out. So, you know, Ben and Jerry's and also buprenorphine, they were doing a great job with both of those. Illinois was excluded due to a protracted period when it was the only state that had repealed its prior authorization. So they had a period of time where basically there was no prior authorizations. So the final analysis was limited to 23 states and 414 state quarters of data. Outcomes of interest, data regarding prior authorization policy was obtained from a variety of sources, including state registrars, archived preferred drug lists, published literature, and news reports to establish Medicaid prior authorization policies of each state. So like a robust form of data was collected to kind of determine policies at the time. They kind of did binary coding, basically authorization present or absent to each quarter. So if at whatever point during the quarter it became elimination of the prior authorization, that quarter would automatically be coded accordingly, with the feeling being that if a change was made, it would come into effect very imminently. They also said that prior authorization was absent if at least one formulation of buprenorphine did not require prior authorization. So a state could still have other formulations like combo or shots, depot formulations, strips versus tablets. They could all still have multiple on formulary that required authorization, but they had at least one without a prior authorization. Buprenorphine prescription counts came from the Medicaid state drug utilization data and was coded with prescriptions per 1,000 Medicaid enrollees age 12 plus. Data was obtained from the Urban Institute from coded inquiries of the Medicaid drug rebate program. Covariates that they also analyzed, there were state-level characteristics related to opioid use disorder burden, sociodemographic, and opioid health policy. So basically, they wanted to see if kind of states that had removed this had different varying characteristics. So looked at things like annual overdose per 100,000, annual number of clinicians certified to prescribe opioid use disorder treatments. That's X-waivered physicians per 100,000. So this is in the X-waiver period of time, not our current situation. The annual number of individuals receiving methadone through an opioid treatment program per 100,000 adults. Annual percentage of individuals 12 and above living below the federal poverty line. State Medicaid expansion status. State proportion of individuals with Medicaid covered under comprehensive managed care plans, and the presence of state-mandated use of PDMPs when prescribing opioids. For statistical analysis, they did this event study framework to compare the number of prescriptions among states that removed buprenorphine prior authorizations versus states that did not remove prior authorizations before and after each state's quarter of policy change. What did you think so far of that?
Pretty good. I mean, I think the definitions are good. It's, you know, usually we do articles that are a little more like in the exam room patient interventions. So this is a, you know, a little bit of a bigger policy article than we normally talk about it. So it's cool to hear about how they kind of defined and collected their data.
So is this trial valid? It was funded by grants from the Human Resources and Service Administration and the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Two of the authors reported receiving fees from multiple other kind of organizations. So National Committee on Quality Assurance, which is a grant from Alchemy's National Institute of Aging, National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Michigan, Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, and the Commonwealth Fund. So not really kind of a strong industry bias. I mean, I guess the Alkermes one had a research grant associated with it, but no clear industry bias. Large national databases derive cross-sectional studies. So they came from the Medicaid State Drug Utilization Database, the CDC Wonder Database, SAMHSA, National Survey on Substance Abuse and Treatment Services, the U.S. Census Bureau, and the Kaiser Family Foundation. There were some database coding limitations. So we talked about like the dichotomous coding of prior authorization status. So there could be some nebulousness there in between. You know, you could have gotten credit for a quarter where really only the last day of the quarter they removed the prior authorization. States could be categorized as prior authorization removal, but they could be different from one another. Like some states could have removed all prior authorizations, some only some formulary or some subgroups of buprenorphine. They did not specifically differentiate pregnancy status. So classically, pregnancy has kind of been exclusion under most plans historically for prior authorization due to the urgency of treatment. So they didn't kind of take that data into account here. There were some state level data limitations. So, you know, some things that they really would have liked to see is there was no individual level like retention, healthcare utilization, or total number of Medicaid enrollees with opioid use disorder. So the thought was, do states that kind of vary, do they have less buprenorphine because of less prescribers and access or less Medicaid enrollees with opioid use disorder? Like, what was the real reason? So we don't have that. This is kind of just associations. Most data came from fee-for-service Medicaid plans. So they talk about the managed care plans, which are kind of increasingly being utilized. They really didn't kind of factor in here as much as fee-for-service. And I guess that's just healthcare in general. I know that we've heard a lot about kind of our transition away from fee-for-service and how many people feel that that's probably the future of healthcare. There's a lack of data regarding dosage and duration of prescriptions as well. So, you know, like I said, it's really kind of more looking like a macroscopic level here, gross picture of kind of what's going on with prescriptions, not really kind of getting into the weeds here of what patients are benefiting from this and what duration, retention to treatment, kind of individual utilization.
Well, and I thought it was a great study. You know, haven't talked about the results yet, but I mean, from my experience, areas of the country that allow more or support buprenorphine prescribing, you know, by eliminating prior auths were also states that supported it in other ways. So it's a little hard to say that the prior auths themselves are the main driver of allowing prescribing. So I can imagine states that don't support buprenorphine use are the same states that require prior auths. And then that lack of support manifests in a bunch of ways. And so, like you said, I think it's a correlation, not necessarily a cause, but I still think this is super important from a physician standpoint, because that's what a lot of doctors early on had said, that that was a reason they didn't want to prescribe buprenorphine, too much headache with all the prior auths. So it is nice to look at that single variable and see if that indeed is a difference, makes a difference.
So the results, so sample 23 states with Medicaid prior authorizations for buprenorphine that required similar prior authorizations for fee-for-service and the managed care plans with at least two quarters of pre- and post-buprenorphine prescribing data. 17 states maintained buprenorphine prior authorization between 2015 to 2019. 6 states removed Medicaid prior authorization for at least one formulation of buprenorphine from 2015 to 2019. And this left us with 414 state quarters of data included in analysis here. Here's kind of the baseline differences between states that maintained and removed prior authorization. So compared to states that removed Medicaid prior authorization, states that maintained Medicaid prior authorizations differed in: they had lower buprenorphine prescriptions per 100,000 Medicaid enrollees, and that was a median of 6.6 versus 24.1 per 1,000 Medicaid enrollees. Had higher percentages of individuals living below the federal poverty limit, so median of 15.3 versus 13.6%. They had a lower likelihood of expanded Medicaid, so it's 5 states versus 4 states. So had fewer Medicaid enrollees under the managed care plan, so median of 38.5% versus 79.5%. And they had fewer individuals receiving methadone through an opioid treatment program per 100,000, so median of 88.3 versus 191.8 per 100,000. So that's kind of how the two differed. I thought it was interesting that compared to states that removed the authorizations, they didn't differ in these areas, which were surprising to me. So no difference between removal of the authorization and maintenance of the authorization and the state's baseline amount of opioid overdoses per 100,000, so 9.4 versus 11.6. The number of ex-waivered buprenorphine clinicians didn't make a difference here per 100,000 population of the state. It's 1 versus 1.8 per 100,000 people. And mandated PDMP reviews. Interestingly, the mandated PDMP reviews was actually very discouraging. It was 3 states versus 1 state. So 17.7% versus 16.7% of the states had mandated PDMP reviewed for controlled substance, which was, I mean, it's a different time frame, but that's kind of sad.
When again was this data? What year?
2015 to 2019.
That wasn't that long ago.
Yeah. So what are the results? So estimated changes in buprenorphine prescriptions per 1,000 Medicaid enrollees comparing states that removed prior authorizations versus those that maintained prior authorizations from 2015 to 2019. Removal of buprenorphine prior authorization was not associated with increased buprenorphine prescribing. And they actually talk about kind of when they looked at it, there was like a minus 1.4% increase per 1,000 Medicaid enrollees. So kind of removal wasn't associated with this big change as expected. And that was with a 95% confidence interval with a range of negative 31.2% to 41.4%. Differences in effect of buprenorphine prior authorization removal in states by varying baseline characteristics. So when you look at those baseline differences between the states and removal of the prior authorization, what were your differences? So compared to states with above median baseline buprenorphine prescribing, states with below median baseline buprenorphine prescribing experienced a larger increase in buprenorphine prescriptions with the prior authorization removal. They talk about 40.1% increase versus a 20.7% possible decrease. So kind of a stronger association when you have a lower starting amount of prescriptions. The effects of buprenorphine prior authorization did not differ by baseline Medicaid, managed care organization penetration. So that didn't make a difference here. Compared to Medicaid expansion states, non-expansion states showed that with prior authorization removal, there was non-expansion states showed an increase in buprenorphine prescriptions. They talked about 27.3% increase. With a very wide confidence interval between negative 22.2% and 108.2%, while expansion states showed a decrease in buprenorphine prescriptions. So again, a relatively wide confidence interval, but they did a 22% decrease with that wide interval. What did you think of those results?
Yeah, pretty good.
Pretty good?
You know, I don't know what to say. Yeah. <You know. laughs> I suppose I should have more of a...
You're not like appalled that removal of the prior authorization didn't have this big, robust effect.
Well, I didn't say it was like I'm happy about the results. It's just, I don't know. I
for God's sakes, feel something here, Sonia.
I feel that doctors who said that the prior auth was, the reason that they weren't prescribing or just full of it and this barrier fell and they still aren't prescribing, you know?
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, so kind of my takeaway for kind of my day-to-day patient care here, I'm an outpatient family medicine doc. I also do addiction medicine. I do prior authorizations all the time. I find them very infuriating and frustrating, probably out of proportion to what they actually entail. I feel like it's one of those things that just triggers all of us. I think it's like, in like a subconscious level, it's also a questioning of our care, right? It's kind of what I feel like it comes down to. And I think we all hate that. Like we feel this is what's needed and insurance is telling us no. And then it's also maddening because half the time you spend 15 minutes on the phone to talk to someone and eventually they just approve it. They just want to waste your 20 minutes of time to approve it. So I think that like probably burden here is out of proportion to how it feels for many of us. I actually really like in my addiction medicine practice in the state of Pennsylvania, I really don't have to do this that often. I actually had I shouldn't have said this when I presented this at the other journal club. I didn't have to, I haven't done this for years. I literally just did this the other day because Christmas is coming up and I have to give some people Sublocade off cycle. That was the first time that I've had to do this, I think, in 4 years, probably. So not kind of affecting me in the day-to-day there. I think that while, you know, I don't formulate healthcare policy, I'm always looking for other reasons to get other people in the fight. I think getting other docs, other APPs prescribing is always something that, like, we're always talking about. I think that other people should join in this effort. So I think that, you know, even if it's a real, if it's real or perceived, I think just elimination of this, especially if it's cost effective and the right thing to do, it's a win for everyone. It just kind of makes it more appealing to provide these services. I think that while the study did kind of, at least on the surface, appear that kind of prior authorization in this Medicaid database didn't make a big difference, I do think it's promising, though, that the baseline groups that had kind of lower buprenorphine prescribing had a stronger uptick. It probably suggests that sort of like the poor performing areas, they're easier lifts, right? So it's easier to go from a D score to a C score than it is to go from an A to an A plus, right? So I think that areas with higher opportunity, this might benefit more so, or at least that's what it would imply to me. So I guess that's my kind of takeaway here. Hopefully that this is one of many tools that could be used to kind of enhance access to these treatments for patients.
Yeah, I guess you felt much more positively about this article than I did. I guess I've been a little bit frustrated with our colleagues or profession. You know, barriers have all fallen to prescribing buprenorphine. There basically are no barriers anymore. You don't need a prior auth. The medicine is covered by all insurances. You don't need an X waiver. You know, the DEA has stopped like raiding our primary care offices just to see if we're pill mills. I don't know. Maybe they're raiding other people, but I haven't seen the DEA in over 10 years in my office. They apparently don't care what I'm doing. And yet still people are, it's like, it's hard to get people to prescribe. So I'm glad this barrier is gone, but I really think it's the big barrier left is just stigma against these patients and stigma against treating opioid use disorder. And I don't know how to get rid of that stigma.
I think that's just going to work itself out with time. Like I think we've talked about this before. I'm much more optimistic about the younger generation. I think that people that are coming out of residency are trained in this now. I think that we recognize it as a disease. You know, I'm not that old. I'm in my late 30s, and really kind of addiction treatment and medication that was really kind of glossed over in medical school. Now it's kind of part of the core curriculum. It's part of core curriculum for multiple residencies. I think that, you know, just the new generation is going to come in here, and as they infiltrate the offices, I think that good stuff is going to come.
I think it will. And I also think the increasing efficacy of buprenorphine, you know, we have different formulations, different treatment protocols. The treatment itself has become a lot easier and more effective, I think. So, I mean, I'm optimistic too, but this article just made me a little bit sad that it didn't make a big difference.
It was 2019 too, right? There's a lot happens in 4 years in these types of topics.
Especially those 4 years. Those were a big 4 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you so much for presenting that article, John. A little different than our typical one, but I think really important, and I'm glad that you presented it. So I have a little bit of feedback for us. We did get some feedback from Dr. Domdarazu, Ilani Domdarazu. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing your name wrong. And she is the lead author of the paper we profiled in episode 33 on polypharmacy and overdose. So the comment was, what she said was, I learned more about buprenorphine from your interesting and engaging discussion. The only thing I would have interpreted differently was the comparison between the two treatment modalities. The confidence intervals hugely overlapped, and it appears that the study's power was not enough to identify any meaningful signals for this question, namely the selection of methadone over buprenorphine and vice versa. So what did you think, John? What do you think of that comment?
Yeah, I think that's a really fair comment. I mean, I think that when, you know, reviewing this article, you know, the primary thing that we talked about was kind of overdose risk with kind of co-prescription of these substances. And we did talk about the caveat that, you know, it was like 72.5% I'm looking at right now were methadone. So there was kind of a lower power for comparison between the two. I'll be honest, I was blown away just by the gabapentin thing that I probably you know, elaborate too much on that, but they did have comparing the individual substances between buprenorphine and methadone, that subgroup analysis, there was very wide confidence intervals that did overlap. So like, while there were differences, you know, it's 100% accurate that with the overlap of the confidence interval, you couldn't really make much difference in terms of the two substances. So I wouldn't kind of take away that buprenorphine co-prescription is riskier than methadone for these substances. Maybe I got too excited with the gabapentin and the antipsychotics and the Z drugs and, yeah, and the benzos being lower, so low on the list that I...
That was pretty...
I perseverated on those and didn't hit the statistics hard enough on that part. I appreciate the correction. That's a good thing for all our listeners to hear.
Yeah, that was pretty exciting about the gabapentin. No, and we love the feedback. We love hearing from authors of the articles we review, and I just love that they listen and that they take the time to teach us and give us some comments. So any of our listeners, if you want to know more or know more about what we're talking about, that was from the article in episode 33 that you can listen to. Thank you for listening to the Addiction Medicine Journal Club. The best part of Journal Club is the conversation, and we want to hear what you have to say. So please send us your comments on social media or email, or join our Facebook group. Or if you are from Central Pennsylvania, you can look us up and tell us in person what you think. We put all the links in the show notes. So the original theme music was composed and performed by Benjamin Kennedy. Audio editing by Aaron McHugh. Produced by Dr. Patrick Beeman and Ars Longa Media. CME support from MyCares. Addiction Medicine Journal Club is intended for educational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. The views expressed here are our own and do not necessarily reflect those of our employers or the authors of the articles we review. All patient information has been modified to protect their identities. Thank you for being part of the conversation. Have a great day.